I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Hello and welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. We have two special guests today. One is Hurricane Hillary, who is showing up in San Diego as we record. So if the wind picks up and we start hearing some howling wind or whatever, that's Hillary. This interview will forever go down in history as the one recorded during the first tropical storm to hit San Diego in 80 years, Sam. So... now, do you prefer Samuel or Sam?
I think Sam is fine, and I'm honored to have Beyond as a co-guest with a hurricane. Feels like there's something palpable about to happen here, David.
Yes, I know. Let's get into Hurricane Tanner. So, Samuel J.
Are you sure? Are you sure, David, that you want to get into that's quite the hurricane?
Yeah. Well, I got a clue into this hurricane right here. With the person on the other side of this book, which for a couple days was me, but it could be y'all out there. So, at the time, the person on the other side of writing this book was Samuel J. Tanner. Our guest today, Samuel J. Tanner, welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. How about that for a smooth intro?
Honored to be here, smoothest of intros. The world dies around us. Let's create some postcards this afternoon, I guess.
Yes, that's a good idea. So listen, this is a really cool science fiction novel from Quire. It's obviously Keith, friend of the show, friend of the pod, friend of the Dickheads pod, Keith Giles, your editor on this, my future editor on People's Park, sent me this book and he was right. I did love it. And so shout out to Keith. Thank you to Keith. But tell us your background, how you got into writing and science fiction, and you know, what works did you have before this one? But let's first just start how you got into writing fiction.
Well, so I should call you David, right? David?
Yeah, I do prefer David. So
all right, so David. That could be a long story that comes spilling out of my mouth here. So please feel free to interrupt and interject or redirect.
I will if I need to. And I've got Rubo's tea to go with it. So, yeah.
So the story of how I got into writing things. It begins with a traumatic childhood, David, that there's traces of that in this book, but I won't go too far into that. But as a kid, one of my favorite ways to find solace was either to play video games or read books. So my father was a Jew for Jesus freak who had the Chronicles of Narnia littered about my childhood. So I read those when I was in like second grade, and those really hit me as a little kid. Middle school, I thought it was really cool to carry around thick novels. I thought that was the way to like win people over, to like show up with a huge like Robert Heinlein novel in middle school.
Sure. As one does,
and quickly learned that that was not an effective social strategy. But I don't know. I was just always sort of an avid reader. Ended up becoming an English major at the University of Minnesota because that's what avid readers do. I will say that I have one of my great memories. My best friend Josh and I were in like eighth grade, like home ec or something, and we were doing career finding. And Josh was like looking into becoming an actuary, which he later would become and now could buy and sell me. And the career that would fit for me was create freelance writer. But the expected annual income for that was $1,000 a year. So that's a hard way to make a go of it.
Now, where was this that you were growing up?
This was all in the Twin Cities. So I was born and raised in a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay. Well, you know, my whole family is Minnesota, has Minnesota origins, even though I grew up personally in Indiana. My father was teaching at Indiana University when I was a kid, but he grew up in Minneapolis. And my mom is from Albert Lea in southern Minnesota. So
Albert Lea is a name I recognize. I almost ended up in Indiana. I had a job offer at Purdue University last year, but when I got there, there were so many smokestacks, David.
Yes, there are. I can't recommend Lafayette, but I grew up with my dad as a IU professor, and they're like rivals. So
they are. Yep, that's right.
However, I will say there. Lafayette does have one banging bookstore. Vaughn's bookstore in Lafayette is very cool. So
the thing that drew me, I had an offer from Purdue and the University of Iowa last year, and Prairie Lights in Iowa City is sort of like the Midwestern literary mecca that sort of sealed the deal on me ending up here in the city.
Well, and David Morrell taught there too, I believe. And you know, one of my favorite authors. I took a workshop from him once and it was incredible. So, you know,
I mean, my like idol Kurt Vonnegut was here for like 1 year before he was like, I can't live in Iowa anymore.
Yeah, well, you're gonna have to show him. Right. So yeah, and look, listen, I can obviously see the Vonnegut influence, but we'll get into that in a little bit. So Minnesota, huh? That's cool. Yeah, I got a lot of Minnesota origins, but I would spend a lot of family vacations in Minnesota. So and a lot of family there. And, you know, Minnesota has Dreamhaven, which is an incredible, incredible bookstore. So,
well, and there's Minnesota. Yeah, I was born and raised in Minnesota. The Loft Literary Center. I took a class years ago after my first year as a high school teacher, which I was getting towards, with a former student of mine who had graduated as well. And he was this brilliant writer. I mean, this kid was amazing. And so we took a class together on improv and writing by an improviser. So another side part of my life is I do improv theater. I was a founder and director of Happy Valley Improv in State College, Pennsylvania, but I'm jumping ahead of my linear storytelling here.
No, that's fine. We can jump around. So it doesn't have to be linear.
So, I mean, the story is I became an English major and then I ended up becoming a high school English and drama teacher. And that's a story in and of itself, which I tell in a memoir, but about 10 years in, a lot of things happened that pushed me back to graduate school. And part of it, in my mind, I was thinking like, oh, I'll go like get my PhD. And while I'm doing that, I'll like write, I'll have finally have time to write because I never have time to write as a teacher. And so I thought I was going to write a story about being a high school teacher, which I've got a bazillion wild and insane things to say about that. But instead of writing that book, I began to write about my best friend who had committed suicide when he was in his early 20s. And my friend Nick, and I was surprised to find this book coming out of me, right?
Right.
Clearly, I was trying to make sense of it. But Nick was actually the one that got me into sci-fi. His dad had every single 1950s, 1960s pulpy sci-fi novel you can imagine on a shelf in his basement, and Nick was brilliant. So him and I would read really wild science fiction together. I mean, we were reading Dune in seventh grade together and talking about how interesting it was. But I started to write this book that was sort of magical, absurd realism about Nick and going actually into the afterlife to interact with Nick. And I bring that up because that book that I wrote about Nick actually became the first iteration of the person on the other side of this book.
Right. And that's Shot Across the River Styx, I imagine.
Across the River Styx was the first book I wrote. It is sloppy, it's messy, and it's weird. And I sort of love it. And it's sort of, I called it a funeral ceremony for my friend Nick, is what I thought of it as when I wrote it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm sorry you had to go through that. But it sounds like at least the writing of that book was cathartic for you. And how do you think he would have reacted to this book? I don't know. I'm sure you've had that question before.
I love that question. Nick was a wild man and he would just say whatever he wanted to say. He repressed very little. I think he would have thought the book was cool. And I think he would have thought this last sci-fi thing that I just did was cooler. But yeah, that book about Nick then that bled into me writing about my alcoholic mother. So again, spoiler alert, hashtag like traumatic childhood was like in the air. But so I wrote this book about my mom, and both of those books came as I was just trying to write stories about being a high school teacher, which eventually I did. So Determined Weeds was about mom. Playing with Sharp Objects became the sort of story being a high school teacher. And so these were three memoirs. A friend of mine made fun of me and called them my weepy memoirs. He said I had to get them out of my system. So that's what I called it, the weepy memoir trilogy. And my reward for finishing those three books all along was always going to be, I was going to let myself write just a ridiculously weird sci-fi novel and just see what came out of it. So yeah, those three books happened. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to write a sci-fi novel. And then this thing happened, which was, I guess with most of my writing, I guess I'm just surprised what happens when I sit down and try to create a project. I think if I wanted to write a book that was like Dune, like just an epic sci-fi, I couldn't do it. Like instead, this thing pops up at me, which...
Right. Well, you know, those are very incredibly different muscles. So, you know, writing a Dune and... you know, that's one of the manuscripts that they have at the Cal State Fullerton Archive is you can go and I've held the straight out of the typewriter first draft of Dune in my hands. And if you ever get a chance, you should, because it's completely red penned and there's entire sections that are crossed out, but you can still read them. So It's very fascinating. And I'm surprised there's never been the uncut vomit draft version of Dune, but it's there. But believe me, there he was good to. I took a picture of like one page, and I've shown it to people, and there's like one section that we're like, yeah, you can tell he had stuff to cut out. But anyways, I could get sidetracked on Dune. Sure. So, So some of your favorites growing up were, you said Vonnegut, like who were the authors you were reading growing up and how do they differ from who you read as an adult?
Well, that's a cool question that I get to answer. So I've started with Chronicles of Narnia, I've said here, but as a kid that hit me. I don't know. I read a bunch of like pulpy, like Frank Herbert and Robert Heinlein stuff when I was like seventh and eighth grade. Kurt Vonnegut has always just been sort of my spirit guide. I just can't get enough of laughing at the things that he creates. Douglas Adams, so Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was really formative for me. That was probably that probably remains my favorite just world to enter into because it's just so ridiculous and funny and interesting. But I don't know, I became like your respectable English major. So I did things like reading Dostoevsky and that sort of thing. But I guess, who do I read now? I went on an Octavia Butler kick over the last couple of years. And really, that's probably my favorite stuff. I've read like everything she did in the past couple of years. And I love what she does. Lately, I'm a college professor these days, so I've gotten into campus satire. I read the novel Straight Man by Richard Russo might be my favorite book I've ever read in my life now. I don't know. I really appreciate literature that like, or books that like actually make you laugh out loud. And I love weird sci-fi. And so that's, again, Douglas Adams sort of is, for me, the sweet spot.
Have you ever read Robert Sheckley?
I saw, because you wrote that beautiful review of my book, which, by the way, thank you, David. I saw that and I Googled it immediately. Like I haven't read anything, no.
Yeah, a lot of people accuse Douglas Adams of getting famous for ripping off Robert Sheckley's style. And a lot of old school sci-fi readers apparently at the time were like, this just reads like Robert Sheckley. Or the rest of the world was like, Douglas Adams is like no one we've ever read before. Well, it's funny because I mentioned a couple of authors that I didn't assume that you knew, but ones that your work reminded me of, like Barry Maltzberg and Robert Sheckley. And it's funny because I know they're more obscure, but they're ones you might want to check out. Because Barry Maltzberg, in the sense of the fourth wall breaking and he did the 101st episode of this podcast is a breakdown of this book with two super fans, and that's of Barry Maltzberg's book Galaxies. But he has one about a time traveler from the 40th century, and like the book is talking to Barry as he's writing it, and this was written in the like 1974. And I thought of Galaxies a bunch when I was reading your book, and assuming that you guys were on like a similar wavelength, but you probably had never, I'm assuming, have you ever heard of Barry Maltzberg?
I have not, and I want to go read that book immediately now. I mean, I'm going to put that on my list. He was speaking to me through the universe.
Yeah, your book's still a little bit wackier than Barry's. Barry is a very kind of grumpy old Jewish guy. Like, he was a grumpy old Jewish guy when he was a young man. So, Barry's still with us in his late 80s, or in his 80s. So, and has been on the Dickheads podcast, and but I definitely recommend Galaxies was one I thought of, and then the Robert Sheckley stuff. Like, I think you're in for a treat finding these authors. And I mentioned them partially because a lot of the people that read my reviews do read Maltzberg and Sheckley, and me making the comparison saying like I felt a lot of Maltzberg and Sheckley in a book that I don't think was directly influenced by them is definitely a selling point. So thumbs up to that. And on that note, breaking the fourth wall, was that the plan with this book all along, or did it, or did you just start writing? Are you a pantser, a planner? What do you do here to write this?
Well, I'm an improviser through and through. I mean, I'm joking about that, but I'm not really like I've been doing improv theater for about 20 years, teaching it, directing it, and performing. And I think of my writing as being very connected to improv, not in sort of this loose sort of whatever happens, but like disciplined improv is about tuning in to what is there and letting something emerge that's unexpected or surprising, right? So
right.
I told you the story about the memoirs. Like, all I knew is I wanted to write this story about this big blob of a creature that lived at the bottom of the ocean on Europa, right? And I knew that that creature was like sentient and could communicate across time and space. And so I thought I was going to tell sort of this like straightforward linear first contact story almost with that thing. And that thing emerged out of writing the book about my friend Nick. It really did. In that book about Nick, The Shot Across the River Styx, I create a character called Magic Fucking Johnson, which is a joke that Nick and I shared when we were immature middle school kids. But Magic Johnson is this character that can travel time and space and allows the narrator, myself, to go and find my friend, right? And so that's
sort of Magic Johnson annoyed that this basketball player kind of took his name?
Yes, he's very pissed off.
I would assume so.
Yeah. He was very pissed off about it. But so all of that is to say, I imagine that there's this creature on the bottom of the ocean of Europa. But as I started to write and sort of riff off of that, the things that came out surprised me. There was a character named Arvin Bingleking, who is sort of the villain of the book, who is a very thinly veiled reference to a person that I worked closely with in my life, but became a place for me to work out some of the like what about that person really like drove me nuts.
It's not a super common name, Arvin, but I just, so you know, I have a student named Arvin where I teach, and when I was reading it, when the name was first introduced, and I looked around and I told my coworkers, I said, there's an Arvin in this book. And everyone was like, what? So that name kind of took me back just for a moment for personal reasons. But yeah.
Well, that's sort of beautiful. And this is crazy, but it's a crazy book. The idea of the energies that spark between the reader and the writer were what started to drive me as I was like, as the book became weirder and weirder, because the things that started to happen were I mean, I really started to explore some of my fears around mortality and some of my anxieties. This book really started to like get finalized right as the pandemic like happened. So that right. isn't.
Well, and I should say that's why in my book review, I talked about in the book, Sam, and outside of the book, Sam. And I kind of thought a lot about that as I was reading it, like not just as I was writing the review, but like, is in the book, Sam thinking one thing and outside the book, Sam thinking another. And it made for a fun reading experience for, and I'm not sure anyone, I think that's a thing writers will think about, but then again, what do I know? I can only read a book as a writer because that's what I am.
Well, so. I think you're right. And I do think this final draft that came out, I felt like there were three plot lines. There was the story of that creature and Arvin Bingleking going to visit this creature to disprove its existence. Then there was the story of Sam in the book, which was like a riff on me, and it wasn't me, but it was a version of me. But then there's the story of the author working all of this shit out. And so in that way, all right, I'll say this to you. There's an improv form called The Herald. The Herald's a very famous, it was Del Close and the committee in San Francisco in the 60s created it. But the idea is the improvisers create three beats in the opening chunk. Then they return to those beats in the second chunk. And then in the third chunk, they let those beats come together, right? So it's a right. structure. So this book became, I used a Herald to riff, to figure out how to put these three distinct universes together. And again, it feels sort of like improv. I think about this book a lot like I would think of an hour and a half improv set that I might do, which is I know the source material. I feel like it's a disciplined riff and iterations on the source material. But where it went is I had no intentions on it going where it went. And it made me laugh. And there were times it made me cry writing it. And I decided I wanted to leave it that way.
Right. And one thing that you can feel good about is that even though it is an improv book, it didn't lose me as a reader who's a structuralist and really likes form and structure to a certain degree in writing. I do read absurdist writers. One of my partners on this, one of my co-hosts on the Dickheads podcast, D. Harlan Wilson, is a noted and very serious absurdist. Who, if you ever, like, for example, just reading his autobiography of Freud that he just put out, he tests my limits all the time as somebody who's a non-structuralist reading absurdist stuff. But the thing that always keeps me reading D. Harlan Wilson stuff is that I'm laughing all the time. There's just turn of phrases that make me laugh. And I thought of his work too a little bit when I was reading your work, especially one of his early science fiction novel, Dr. Identity, that's like, leans more to sci-fi than complete absurdism. And that's one of the things I do want for people to know if they haven't already gotten the book, if they're listening to this interview without having read it. And we'll give a spoiler warning before the part of the interview where I think you should have read it before you continue to listen. But for now, I would say that I think there's enough science fiction. You're kind of playing and being very playful with science fiction, but there's enough here. And one of the kind of jokes I had in my review was that every time I would start to feel like now we're getting more traditional science fiction. And then there'd be something hilarious and weird that came along. And that's a feature, not a bug, right? So at least in my opinion, it's a feature, not a bug. But there's enough science fiction that I think people will feel like comfortable and at home there. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, because clearly you still read science fiction or still appreciate science fiction, right? So.
I adore science fiction. And if I could, I'd write a really straightforward science fiction book. And I probably could if I flexed that muscle, but I don't know. This is, something did feel alive about this. And I will say those three memoirs I talked about too, I think about these four books together. I don't know how good they are as books. I don't know how many people will be like moved by them, but they felt alive when I was making them. And I'll say that I've had enough people like connect with me through those books. Like, it's just, there's a great honor to know that you spent time with that book and like, and that there was a guy named Arvin near you as you did. There's just something sort of wonderful about that to me. Like when I was 13, if you would have asked me what I want, I would have said, I want to be Stephen King and make my life out of like writing. And now that I'm 43, I just want to make stuff that feels alive. And I hope that other people will experience it with me. And that's part of the person on the other side of this book. It's this idea of this like trying to connect with each other. I mean, there's absurdism in this book, but I feel like we're living in an absurd moment. There is a hurricane on its way to this podcast right now. The landscape around us is so wild that I don't know what else to do but to make wild things.
Right. And so here's the other thing that's interesting too. And this concept of the person on the other side of the book too. Every writer has thought about this, at least they should, because there's moments, at least I think more so when you're doing second drafts or edits or proofs or whatever, but you start to really start thinking about, and I don't know how you feel, but I think all the time, like I have certain people that I think of when I think of who's going to be reading this. And every once in a while I have a thought like, a particular line will occur to me like, oh, so-and-so is going to get this, or maybe not everyone's going to get this, but this person will get this. I have moments like that all the time. And my most recent, in my book that just came out, The Last Night to Kill Nazis, like one of the things is that that book is meant to be like a classic World War II mission book, but with a vampire, right? And so I had to do vampire versions of all the classic tropes from Guns and Navarone and Dirty Dozen and stuff like that. And there was at least a few scenes where I was like, well, this is the cliche moment from that type of movie done with a vampire spin. And I was like, and I knew that not everyone's going to understand that, but I was like, this is entirely for the people. This scene is entirely for the people who love those movies and watch those movies and think about those movies, and they're going to get it. And if everyone else doesn't get it, that's fine. And for example, The Vegan Revolution with Zombies, the book that I wrote, that book operates on three levels. If you ever lived in Portland, that book speaks to different people. If you've never seen a zombie movie, it's not going to make as much sense. If you've seen zombie movies, it's going to speak to you. But if you're a vegan, lived in Portland, and like zombie movies, you're going to get everything, right? So what are the things that, with this book, that you think specifically readers, like, can you think of a moment that, like, is kind of between you and a few specific readers in this book?
Yeah, that's such a great question, David. And the first thing I'm going to say is going to sound so pretentious and make me seem like a maniac on your
podcast. Well, I talked a long time to ask that question, so don't tell me it's a good question. A good question would have been shorter.
Oh, but it's interesting to think about. Here's the first thought that comes into my mind. All right. So I was a high school English and drama teacher for about 15 years. It was it was a profession I loved as much as I hated. And I think that I was very funny. I think I'm a funny person, David.
Your book's funny. So
Thank you. I appreciate it. But I found that as I got further along in my teaching career, I began to make jokes sometimes when I was teaching, and I still do this as a college professor now, where I'm making myself laugh, and I don't even know if anybody in the room understands why what I'm saying is funny, but I still can't help myself but to go into that space, right? So the first thing I'll say is this book made me laugh like crazy, and I found that like making myself laugh, I don't know. I just trusted that was like an okay thing to do. And so there's all sorts of little jokes in this book that are like, God, I don't even know that I want to say this. The Arvin character, even the name of Arvin Bingle King, is a riff that one of my best friends, who's a close collaborator of mine, him and I write comedy together. So we write a lot of insane improvisational comedy. I knew he would howl with laughter when he saw what I did with that name, because he knows the person who it's based on, right? That was enough for me for that, like, that's just funny. It might not be objectively funny, but it's funny in a context. And so I don't know, I feel like the book works like that in a lot of places. If the kind listener of this podcast went off and purchased this book and thought, well, that was fun, and then that kind listener went off and read the three weird memoirs I wrote leading up to it, I think this book is almost a satire of the three memoirs that I wrote. It's like revisiting trauma, childhood trauma. And I think it's real. Like, look, I already talked about my alcoholic mother, my friend who committed suicide. Like, that shit's real. This book, all of those things are in this book. They're just sort of transmuted into this sort of fantastic world. But that's where, like, Sam is me and not me, right? It's almost all like an inside joke, which I don't think is a good way to strategic way to write a novel, but that is kind of what happened here.
Yeah. So it's funny because I think the inside jokes and the things like those are fine, because you're also sometimes going to make people laugh with things that they don't even realize, or probably didn't even realize you were going to make people laugh. Right. And I wrote a short story for my short story collection called Value Menu. And the whole story was about a woman in a senior citizen home, like, explaining her conspiracy of how she murdered her husband by letting him eat fast food. And I thought the story was really, really funny. And I had read it at readings and people always laughed. And then I had a reading slot at a vegan festival. I'm vegan. And I read it there and no one laughed when I read it there. It was like, it was really interesting to see how, like, the different audiences, like, respond to things. I always tell the story of how when Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, I saw it opening night with a bunch of young people. And when he said, "I like Ike," in the one scene, and absolutely zero people laughed in the theater. But then 3 weeks later, I saw it with my senior citizen father on a Monday afternoon, and everyone in the theater had gray hair but me. And everyone laughed at the "I like Ike" joke. What makes people laugh? It's so impossible to understand or know ahead of time.
I want to speak into that for a second, because
yes,
I love
that up.
So one of the things I used to do, I'm a teacher of improvisers, right? And one of the hardest things for improvisers to get over is the constant need from validation from the audience, right? If the audience is not laughing at you, does that completely disrupt your work of improv? And if you're actually looking for their laughter, Stephen Nachmanovich is a great improviser. He's got a great book, Free Play. And in it, he says that the minute you start worrying about whether or not what you're making is good or bad, you've actually stopped improvising. You've stopped doing the thing, because you're stuck in evaluation. I gave myself permission for this book, and it's something that, as a writer, I keep working towards, like, to give myself permission to not worry about whether it's good or bad, but to follow what feels alive about it. And then there's things that surprise me, things that make me laugh. This book made me weep. There's a scene at the end that when I first wrote it, I was just in tears. It was like the height of the pandemic. It was like, there was just something about it that hit me hard. And I tried my best to leave those things in there, in the same way that if a good improv set hits you, you don't want to edit it. You don't want to make sense of it. You don't want to rationalize it. You want to leave it as it is. At least I do. And that's sort of part of the sensibility, I think, that I hope this book actually captures a little bit of.
Right. And one of the things that, I do think that's great. You got to be able to improv with the idea that, I mean, just think about, some humorists build up a lot of what they do on those moments when no one's laughing, and, you know, and you can turn that into humor too. Like the fact that no one's laughing at you. Well, look, and one of the things, well, I want to do before, I want to get into spoilers so I don't take up too much more of your time, and we will have officially beat the hurricane. But is there anything else that you really feel like before, if there's somebody who has not bought the book yet or has not read it yet, or maybe they've already, you know, run over to the internet in another window and bought it while we're talking, but they haven't read it yet. So what do you think is a last thing that you really want to clue people into before they read this book? Like what feelings were you looking for people?
I mean, the very first line that came out that really hit me, and I hope I quote it right. It's my own book, so I should get this right. It's so good to be alive, even better to be aware. Right? Like this idea that like there's actually something joyful and good about existing and actually being aware of our existence. One of Kurt Vonnegut's, one of my favorite things he's written, he wrote over and over, was life is no way to treat an animal. Like it's terrible to be alive. And here's all the reasons why. And I honor that. And I actually think that this book was almost about teaching myself that like it's pretty cool to be alive. And it's pretty cool to share that life and vitality with somebody else. And this book for me is a way to reach out across time and space and connect with another person and hope that something good comes from that. So I don't know. I'm honored when folks like take time to enter into what I make. And I think something cool happens, even if it's just that there's a guy named Arvin next to you. And that's kind of funny.
Well, yeah, that was a weird moment. All right, so we're gonna get into spoilers. I should have a bell that I ring or something. I've just grabbed a pair of scissors, so I'm just gonna go, here's your spoiler warning. With the scissors have now been used. We're in spoilers now. So we're assuming at this point that you've either read the book or you're some weirdo who wants to continue to listen to this without having read the book. You're cheating if you've done that. But I'm going to jump straight to page 63, and I'm going to read you something, and I want to talk about this line. This is only a moment, I said, a small dot on an infinite journey. Imagine a spiral. I don't want to write an autobiography, Talia said with smiling eyes. I want to write about these dying people. It's impossible not to write autobiographies. The stuff comes out of us is the stuff inside of us, around us. Obviously, you're reacting to your first four books, right? You're like, yeah. Okay. But I think this is part of the mission statement of the book, is it not? Here.
It is. And while I'm reacting to the first three books, right, I guess, and the fourth, I guess, as I'm writing it, the other thing I would say is I've been teaching writing now for 20 years of my life as a high school teacher and as a college professor. And it is impossible for me not to see the words that come out of people as refractions of their experiences. I had a great improv teacher once say that, like, people get it wrong when they think that improvisers are coming up with something off the top of their head, or they have to be really funny or really clever. No, like, human beings are wildly complex, and improvisers learn to tune in to that complexity, right? And so for me, writing, it's hard to disentangle the writer, but also the reader from the writing, which might sound like a silly thing to say, but like, there's some sort of multiplicity or complexity of tuning into the stuff that comes together through the book and then the sharing of the book. That sounded pretentious and insane, David. But
for people who have not had the experience of writing a book, putting it out and talking to somebody who's read it later, they might not understand what a weird psychic connection it is between the moment when you're sitting there writing the book and the person's reading it. you know, I'm consciously aware of that every time I'm reading a book. And I read over 100 books a year, but I think about that all the time. And I think that most writers do, writers who really think about the process, because it's impossible not to really consider what it means when you've had that psychic connection. It's just a weird, odd thing.
Well, you know? To add on to that, the character that you in that moment is Talia, and she's this college student, but she really is a riff off of a couple of different high school students I remember working closely with. So much, and I was a writing teacher all along. So much of my writing pedagogy relied on one-on-one writing conferences with students. And I found that those spaces became so, the word intimate sounds like, but I think that's what they were. They became spaces where I was thinking alongside these people as they were trying to craft, whether it was academic writing or creative writing. Like, there's such possibility in thinking together in those spaces when you've got a mentor with you or when you've got a student with you. There's a relationship that happens there that feels emotional, spiritual, psychic, something. And so that's mm-hmm. the part, like there's an auto... Like, yes, we are in those moments. Even if you're writing some sort of academic essay, your consciousness is still there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I have to ask you about on page 71, there's a 70 and 71, there's really great conversation. And part of it, they're talking about the, I believe they're talking about this. It's been a little bit since I read it. I believe they're talking about the spaceship in this story, and the spaceship confused me in all the right ways. Like, so I just wanted to ask you, like, how, just from in your like conversational way, like, how do you describe this ship? Because like, there were certain parts when I was reading this where it's like that, you know, you literally ask the question, is the ship made out of concrete? Like, in here. And so there's all kinds of like, and that was just a reaction to somebody saying it's very concrete. But anyways, the whole thing is funny. Like this whole conversation about the ship and the, and like, I like how you say, you know, how, you know, there's a part where it says, you know, they went to the room that on Star Trek, they'd call it the bridge, which is just, you know, a very frank way of doing science fiction, right? So tell me about the ship.
Yeah, so I mean, the way I would conversationally describe it is it's a big fucking ship. So that's just, I hope I can say the F word on this. Did I just break up?
You're fine.
Okay. Thank God. So it's just a big like ship, but part of, in my mind, I was thinking about the incomprehensibility of this vessel that is like not human, right? And trying to describe that in human words, I don't know, some of like, I'm a huge science fiction fan, but some of the annoying science fiction I read is when we sort of like there's almost, you simplify like an otherworldly being or an entity. What's the wild, it was a movie, but it was from the 60s and it was a great novel, Solaris, right?
Yeah, I actually thought you were going to say Solaris, yeah. Stanislaw, okay. Yeah, Stanislaw Lem.
Yes.
Lem, so, the Polish.
Yes. Right. What I love about Solaris is you go through the whole book and you still have no conception of this world that these people are sort of above, other than it's aware, it's alive, and it's so not human, right? And so I knew in my mind it was a huge spaceship that they'd found underground that was going to carry them off into the universe as part of their journey towards the creature. But it was also like incomprehensible. And so it's almost like the characters making jokes about trying to fit what they're seeing into their own conceptual framework. And it doesn't work, but it does work. It's enough that like, we know it travels, we know it goes into space, but there's an incomprehensibility to it. And I just feel like it is disingenuous for me to try to put some sort of like human spin on the thing that they were entering into. And right. The only way I could think to do it of was like they joke about how wild it was.
Right. And it is very funny. the best humble brag that's been on this podcast in a long time was I had Ray Naylor on, and I brought up his book reminding me of Stanislaw Lem, and he said, he was in the middle of talking about his work, he said, I try to read his work in Russian because it's the closest to his original language. And I was like, did he just brag that he reads Lem in Russian? And I was like, that's so cool. But Lem liked to do that, by the way, write about the work, the universe, but being just so incomprehensible. In fact, he had one about First Contact called His Master's Voice, too, that, like, you know, the whole book is just like about us just never being able to understand aliens. And he does it in a really dry way, and you found a pretty cool way to make it funny. So I like that. Chapter 7 is probably one of my favorite moments of this book. And what's funny is I had stopped reading for the day on page 131. And then I picked up the next day, and I was sitting in a very lovely location, watching, looking at the Pacific Ocean as the sun went down. And this is the paragraph I read. And so, yes, I rested in my tiny apartment in a dying city on a dying planet. But I also traveled. And there I called you stupid one last time. And then you go into this whole scene of basically calling the reader stupid. And I like how you said, I bet you thought I'd wait till the epilogue, but no. And what was really funny to me about this part is that this first paragraph, you know, a tiny apartment in a dying city and a dying planet. And I also traveled. And at that point I was like, oh, it's going to get deeper. And then the very next sentence you called us all stupid. And I just thought this was absolutely hilarious and just set the tone for, because I had just sat down and was planning to read 100 pages. And so it was just a really great way to sit down and start my reading session. And I wanted to mention that because part of the theme of the book is, of course, that relationship between the book and the reader. And that this was a very good example of theme meeting like the moment. And you know, you talk a couple times in the book about how the words flickered on the page, and I really love that too. But I thought a lot about that as this scene like kind of lulled me into this book. So, you know, bold move calling your reader stupid, but halfway through the book. So Can you tell me about that?
I can. First off, what a beautiful thing to imagine you sitting there, like gazing out on the Pacific Ocean, reading this book. Like there's just something so good about that frankly, I like a whole lot more than 10 million book sales or whatever. Like there's just something cool about that. And secondly, yeah, I don't know what else to say other than it made me laugh like a maniac to imagine an author calling the reader stupid. And I did it twice in the beginning, so I had to do it a third time because of the rule of comedy. But then I do think I say something. I'll say this. All along the way, one of my biggest coping mechanisms is a very sarcastic sense of humor that has seen me through a lot of like troubling times. But as I get older, makes it harder for me sometimes to be genuine with folks, right? And I think part of this book is almost shrugging off that defense mechanism throughout. And I actually think that moment in chapter 7, it's still, I think, a funny book from that point on out. But I think I also challenged myself to be a lot more sincere, even as the world around it got more and more absurd. And I think of the end of this book as being very sincere and in a ways that I typically don't let myself be.
Yeah, absolutely. I like, too, that the European fish, I like page 160, he says, I'm one hell of a creature. And I like how he kind of takes on, I should say this creature takes on all kinds of, has a really funny personality. But it's also on this page where you really, you kind of go off in one part where this is where you break the wall on this page with like what's going on in the world. You said it's a mess, the election, the virus, the smog, this book. Do you remember what your father told you? He wanted to knock my marbles around. He told me all the time, never did though. He also told you the devil keeps you all screwed up. And then, but it's really that it's a mess, the election, the virus. It's just for that moment, breaking that wall. So just think that that's a really interesting moment for the book. So,
And I
don't know if you have anything to say about that scene, but.
I don't, other than I'll say this. I think the moment that contextualized the finishing of the book was so interesting. In the original version of this, the epilogue actually isn't what it was. It was actually just a really honest, almost memory bit. If you've ever read Bluebeard by Vonnegut, I think it's Bluebeard. He opens up the intro to that book is just some like gut-wrenching memoir from him that's both funny and horrifying. And then he like propels himself into this fictional book that he's created. And I almost felt like I was doing a reverse of that. But it wasn't the right move. It was just, I the writing of this book made me really like vulnerable. and yeah, I'm talking about my dad there, right? And yeah. I'm making sense of my dad in ways I probably hadn't before. And again, even if I was trying not to write autobiography, I just think it's more honest to admit that we are.
I don't mean to drill down so much on one fucking page of the book, but my favorite, you know, thing in the book is this, you know, talking about like the sponsorships and who's and the donors of the of the ship, and then the owner of the Lakers face giving away to the Nike swoosh, and then comes the sentence which. After all that, having the sentence Jupiter's moon was a pleasant distraction from the thickening smog and drier coughs, you know, like without the humor setting up that really like brutal, dark line, I don't think it would be as powerful. So to me, that was my favorite moment of writing in this book. So it was enough that I dog-eared the page and, you know, made a little pen mark. So make sure I commented on it in my review, because that was the most powerful moment in the book for me. So I don't know how that makes you feel, but to me, that was the moment that really hit me. So
it's beautiful to hear you say that. I'll share this with you. I have a doc student I'm working with at Boulder, cause I'm a professor. And they're a theater student, and they're actually looking at improv and climate change as their research area. And they started reading this book, and they were like, holy shit, this is about improv and climate change. Like, they added this book to their list for their comps question. And I hadn't thought about it that way, but it absolutely is. I mean, one of the harsh realities underneath this book, and the fact that there's like a hurricane on its way towards you right now, right, is like the world is like fucked up right now. The climate catastrophe is real. And I don't know. There's a great line in Kurt Vonnegut's Man Without a Country from 2003, where he says something along the lines of, look, the earth is going to be a skull of crust and bones, and there's nothing you can do about it anymore, right? And I used to teach that book in 11th grade English. And that line always hit those kids in 2003 like a ton of bricks. I mean, Vonnegut's argument was like, it's cute that you want to go green, but that's done now. And so I think there's this like, I mean, the harsh reality of our situation is present in this book in the same way it's present around us right now.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of this book as a cli-fi book, but now I see it that way. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
The student changed my mind. I hadn't thought of that at all. I didn't know what I thought. I just thought the book was weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking, you know, as a person who's been like, trying to sound the alarm about climate change since the early 90s seriously, and then, you know, has written a cli-fi novel, I think the thing about it is there, I don't think you can write science fiction in this era without addressing climate change. You can't. you know, it's impossible. It's impossible not to. So, yeah. All right. So, anything else you want to say about this book? You talked about the sincerity of the ending. It's funny because I had that moment, you know, a little bit further from the end that really hit home for me. It's funny too, the other thing about Ephraim, there's a Ephraim in my favorite horror novel of all time, and that's not a common name either. So that's a
what horror novel is that?
That would be Wet Bones by John Shirley, which is a underrated John was battling heroin addiction and getting clean, and wrote this very angry novel about the monster of addiction, and it's an incredible book. But the main character's name is Ephraim, so I just it's interesting because I just kept seeing that name. So am I right or wrong that Ephraim is this being, you know, it's the kind of the flickering in and out, which just seems like a little trick early in the beginning, but what is happening, that actually plays into the ending more so than it's a thing you forget about. And this is a tactic I love with writers, is if you can introduce something early in a book and you notice it, but you don't really notice it, and then at the end, you know, it becomes important. The flickering was more important than just a joke or just a little flare, right? Towards the ending.
For sure. And something I'll say about Ephraim. So it's at somewhere along the way while I was writing this book, I came across this like transcription that the CIA did of doing these like mind traveling experiences where they had an agent who thinks that they went to Mars in their mind like a million years ago and tells the story of these people who were dying out, right? And it's I find this, I cannot remember how this came across my desk, but it's this wild little like CIA document where this guy was interviewed, and so for me, like, I imagined this people that lived and then died out. And I imagined what I was seeing around me was an example of people, us, like not doing so great. And so, like, again, it was sort of an improvisational riff off of tuning into some like sci-fi stuff, but some really like deep sort of horrifying stuff too. I don't know what else to say about that other than that character sort of came from that. And I tried to start to imagine what it is to let yourself die off, and then what comes after you die off. Like, those are interesting questions to me.
Mm. Well, yeah. And I think, it's a journey. It's part of all of our journey eventually. So, you know, it's a thing you have to think about. The ending of this book though, you know, it's not to say, because I still think that there's things that made me laugh towards the back end of this book. So it's not like the humor kind of like goes away. But I think, you know, it definitely gets a little bit more poignant towards the end. But I think, speaking as somebody who's deeply inspired by Philip K. Dick, I can be, and you're somebody who's deeply inspired by Vonnegut, these are tough shoes to kind of be influenced by and try to jump into and try to jump into those styles, because they come to the world with such a unique position. But what's awesome is so do we. So, you know, we have this thing. And I think one of the things that, you know, I appreciate about this book is that it's a very unique experience that is deeply tied to the creation and its creators. So the best books that we have out there are the ones that are unique to that nobody else could do. I mean, the people who, you know, write ads, marketing books, you know, this meets this, you know, they don't see it that way, but I think readers do. And I think they will appreciate that about this book. So
I mean, I'm really honored by that, David, to hear that from you.
Inside of the spoiler warning, and I guess I should have done like how do people get in touch with you before we went to spoilers, but within the spoiler context, is there anything else you want to say about this book that I might have missed?
About the book, I don't know the end of it. If you've ever read the book Time Quake by Kurt Vonnegut, which funnily is like one of my favorite of his books, the end of the book was really trying to sort of be inspired by that. It was inspired by a walk I took with my wife through the Pennsylvania wilderness. I finished this book when I was living in State College, Pennsylvania, Penn State town. And there's just a moment where like the real author like steps into the book and has an interaction with these people that really hits me hard. And then the end of the book is just like making peace with a dying world and trusting that like life carries on in some way. I don't know, that sounds really cheesy, but I feel like that is where the book got. And I just found myself so moved personally by the end of it. So to share that with others and to be able to sit here and talk about it with you for an hour, man, like that's just wild. I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate it too. If folks want to continue on this conversation with you, maybe they want to become a student, maybe they should become a student in Iowa. But other than that, how do people find you and your books online?
My dean would love it if you wanted to become a graduate student of mine here at Iowa. But in all seriousness, you could find me. I've got a website, samjtanner.com, with all my like writing stuff on it. If you Google search Samuel J. Tanner, University of Iowa, you will find my email address in a couple of clicks. I'm happy to interact with folks that way. I think on my website, there's a way to reach out to me as well. But yeah, like I say, the thing that has been cool to me, these three memoirs and this book have happened over the course of about, it's been 7 or 8 years, I guess, since they've been out in the world. And I can't tell you the joy it brings me to connect with folks over these weird books. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm very excited to talk to you about this. I'm also impressed that you didn't want to take the job at Purdue because Lafayette does suck, even though Lafayette did produce Axl Rose. So we'll give him credit for that.
That was the one thing I heard in the job interview that I was like, shut up. Axl is from Lafayette. That almost sold me right there.
Well, there's a big difference between Lafayette and West Lafayette, too.
The river. Yeah.
You know, growing up, I had a lot of friends in the hardcore scene that were from Lafayette, and the hardcore kids from Lafayette were really cool. So I'll just say that growing up that I did really enjoy, and two really cool hardcore bands came out of the Lafayette West Lafayette combo. But so it's not the worst place in the world, and they do have Vaughn's bookstore, which is a great bookstore, and I'll give them that. And they have a really nice library in West Lafayette, I will say.
I'm sure it's a beautiful place. Iowa stole me because it's closer to Minneapolis, and we had spent 8 years out in Pennsylvania, and I kind of wanted to be closer to home.
Yeah, I get that. But yeah, no, you can bash Lafayette all you want, being a Bloomington guy. On that note, folks should find this book. I'm going to eventually, I definitely want to read Shot Across the River Styx. For sure. The high school memoir sounds really interesting too. I'm sure I'll get to all of them eventually. This was a fantastic book. What are you working on next? Anything?
I've got this really weird with my collaborator who I've talked about before. We do comedy, and we've written a novel of email exchanges to represent the 2022-2023 school year at a fictional university that we've called Dim Horizon State University. It's meant to be like a campus novel, and it sort of just pokes fun at all the things that sort of annoy us. So I'm hoping to get that out in some way. We've actually even started to work on the sequel to it because it's a lot of fun to write fake emails to each other.
That does sound really interesting and fun. All right. On that note, Mr. Tanner, it was an honor to have you on this here podcast. The rain is actually not increased a lot. So I'm even thinking about going for a run before the storm hits. So we'll see how.
David, nothing more hardcore than running through a hurricane.
That's true. Yeah, we see the one thing that's got me a little worried about it is that we're close enough to the ocean and we get these like that sometimes the water drains don't go fast enough and we do get these little puddles that are impossible to avoid. And it's only so wet I want to get my shoes. So we'll see how it goes. So on that note, we'll be sure to have you back for another book at some point. Thank you for joining us on Postcards from a Dying World. For folks out there, I believe the next episode after this one will be another of our World War II movie series to promote The Last Night to Kill Nazis. So look for that. I do know we're probably going to be watching A Bridge Too Far at least. So folks should watch A Bridge Too Far if you want to keep up with the World War II movie mini series. And then I am throwing around the idea of doing an episode on Foundation on Apple TV because hot take alert, I think Foundation, the TV series, is better than the Asimov books. So yeah, take that hot take out there. I like that show. And I know a bunch of you crusty old sci-fi fans hate it, but it's actually pretty good. So on that note, folks, come back for those episodes. And I know I'm going to be interviewing Philip Fracassi soon. So that's one that's coming up. And Brian Asman's coming on, the author of Man Fuck This House, which is a excellent haunted house novel. If you haven't read it, Man Fuck This House by Brian Asman. He should be coming on soon. So folks, come back for those and we'll see you soon. Thanks.